Good evening. It is just about 6 p.m. or just at 6 p.m. here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. And of course, you can also stream us online at weft.org. My name is Ben Theobald. You might be familiar with me. Starting right now is Where Are We At? This is a public affairs show or program that will cover a lot about politics on the local state level. So like, I want to get to my interview with Stephanie Frank Smith. She is a candidate for the Illinois Congressional District 13th. So district that includes Champaign and Urbana, and of course other parts of Springfield, Decatur, and so on. So I'm not going to waste too many time because the interview is will take roughly about this whole hour. So just again, this is my interview with Stephanie Frank Smith. So I am talking to Stephanie Frank Smith, who is running for Congress here in the Illinois 13th Congressional District. You started you announced your campaign, I believe, around September. Was it Labor Day?
Yes, so I had been asked to run, and I had to take a little bit of time to think about it. I had to do some research, check in with my family, and that sort of stuff. So I actually agreed to run on Labor Day is when I said yes. Yeah. So we're still a fairly young campaign.
And what made you want to run, or what was kind of the the moment where you, or
yeah. Absolutely. The biggest thing for me was that no one was speaking about the issues that mattered to me. I have a history with poverty and homelessness that I've been very open about. I've been allowing that to sort of drive my work. After the 2016 elections, I had still been out of school because of a medical issue. I was debating going back. I had wanted to go for my PhD in linguistics, but then I felt like I didn't have enough time to really do that. And so I was looking for other ways to serve people that have histories more like mine. And when I looked at the other candidates and the way that the issues were being discussed, I wasn't seeing anything that I felt was reassuring in that regard. So I decided that this is a way that I can serve the people that really, really need attention in our district. The most vulnerable people are being suppressed and marginalized politically, economically, just really in every capacity. We've got food insecurity, we've got housing insecurity, we've got low wages, we've got issues with access to health care, and nobody is really taking up the cause of working class people. So that really sealed it for me, is that I didn't see anybody championing the people that really needed it.
Yeah, I believe and you've been doing videos on kind of on Facebook. One of your first, because you were talking about how, you know, here in Champaign County, 60% are here in residents are eligible for SNAP benefits. And you're talking about, I think 60, if I have this stat right, 62%, just 62% kind of a rent burden for seniors. These are just kind of some of the
issues. Yeah. Kind of so the numbers differ a little bit by county within the district. The 60% eligible for SNAP is a district-wide number. So that's the federal nutrition program that the federal government has been cutting eligibility for, cutting funding for. That also includes things like school lunch programs in a lot of places. As far as rent burden for seniors, we are finding that it is very, very difficult for people to live on fixed income because it is not adjusting for inflation, and rental prices are skyrocketing. And that seems to be something that is happening everywhere. It's not just something that is happening in our district. It's a statewide issue. It's a nationwide issue. The lack of, I don't want to say the lack of housing, because that's not true. There are plenty of homes. The lack of access to housing that people can actually afford has become a problem. I know that one of the most frightening things for me is that we don't have year-round LIHEAP. So when we talk about seniors that have this exorbitant rent burden, what we're talking about are people who are going to have to delay paying power bills, right? And what happens in the summer when they have to run their air because they have asthma or they have medical devices that require electricity? What happens when they can't afford those bills? Their utilities get shut off, and this leads to people dying. This is actually a life or death issue for many, many seniors and disabled people. It's, I mean, it's heartbreaking that we've allowed this to happen. And honestly, I really believe that we need to make sure that even in our local elections, when we're talking about city council, we're talking about county boards, when we're talking about the places that deal with housing, we need to be electing more people that are from the backgrounds that are affected by this stuff. We need working class representation in those seats, because these people do not understand how dire the situation is for most people in our district. You know, we've got elected officials claiming that, you know, it doesn't feel poor here. And it's like, well, it doesn't feel poor to you because you don't run in the circles that most people do. You know, it's really, really easy for wealthy people to isolate themselves from the problem. You know, they partition poor people off. They start getting heart eyes for a $47 million jail instead of a homeless shelter, you know? Like, no, it doesn't feel poor because you're putting the poor people in cages so you don't have to look at them. That's why it doesn't feel poor.
And this is your first time ever running for any kind of public office?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Given my history, I just kind of figured that would always be off the table for me. The irony being that I am doing this because of my history. I had always considered politics to be something that was really more of a playground for the upper class. I had never had designs on being a politician. I lack that sort of drive for self-promotion. I'm not really into money. I'm not a person that desires a lot of power. I'm a person that desires collective action, and the history of mainstream politics, particularly in the two-party system, has never really reflected my values well. So I've always been a bigger fan of on-the-ground action, organizing, and service than politics, but we've hit a point where the way that legislation is being passed, who is informing it, it's just not working for us.
And you would call it your campaign a grassroots campaign, correct?
I would, yeah. We're of the dirt. Absolutely. I don't take money from corporations. I have endorsed the Homes Guarantee from People's Action, which means that I cannot take any real estate money or money from landlords. I have a very principled approach to this. I cannot be bought. I only want the support of the people who really want to get involved because it will better their lives. I don't want the support of people who feel like they can buy my opinion.
And you begin some endorsements from I believe DS Democratic Socialist of America. I believe
Shambana DSA and Central Illinois DSA have both endorsed me.
I think Peoria, or I thought was it Peoria, or am I mis?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't think they have yet.
Not yet. Maybe they will.
But if you're listening,
yeah.
Yeah, this is kind of a new world to me in terms of going around to political groups, because I'm more accustomed to activist groups. And so the DSA has been amazing in that regard, because the people that are involved that I have met are just incredibly engaged in their community in ways that are really, really meaningful. And they do things like issues-based canvassing, and they really care about what happens to people. I'm so grateful that through this process I've actually sort of found people that are politically motivated in the same sort of way that I am.
And what would you say has been kind of response from just, you know, in the community, you know, when you say, hey, you know, I'm running for Congress, you know, I'm not your typical, you know, I'm not somebody who obviously usually run, you know, is been involved, or you know, I'm not a career politician, you know, and you know, you're running against, you'll probably be running against other candidates like Betsy Dirksen Lonergan, who was the Democratic nominee in 2018. So what's, you know, I know you've been hitting kind of the campaign all around the county, and Bloomington, Normal, you know, here in Champaign, and I guess it also our district also covers Springfield?
Yes, it does. It's a very large district.
Yeah, it's large.
Actually really hard to get around to so many places. Mm. There are so many events that I wish that I could go to and so many places I wish I could support, and we're working on it, but like I said, we're pretty young still.
Yeah.
Which is a good time for me to say, if you would like me to visit your groups, feel free to reach out to me on my website or social media, because I'm very, very into it. But the response so far has been really incredible in many ways, given my history and how open I've been in talking about my experiences with sexual violence. I have had so many people come up to me after I've spoken to say that, you know, they're so proud of me, they feel comforted by this, that they think what I'm doing is really bold and they appreciate it. And just this idea that we have a right to talk about our histories without shame seems to be resonating really well among people. The response has been wonderful when I have gone to rallies and picket lines. I'm obviously very, very supportive of working class issues. People deserve fair contracts, and seeing people come together in that way and unite for their rights is just really inspiring to me. And so I think when I'm in those spaces, there's this sort of mutual twinkle in our eyes, you know.
You went to the Chicago teacher, I believe that was like the first when it started.
Yes.
The Chicago Teachers March. What could you kind of talk about that experience? Because that was, you know, that lasted for quite a while. And it was this kind of this back and forth between Chicago Mayor Lightfoot and, you know, the Chicago Teachers Union.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, if you want to talk about.
Yeah. So, you know, supporting the teachers is really, really important, and I mean that in a national sense, in a global sense, in like from a place of like values and morals. That's very, very important to me. But when I saw that the CTU was also taking up the cause of housing for their students, that is the sort of movement that brings tears to my eyes, because that is something that would have actually changed my life growing up. I was homeless and 12 years old. I lived in an abandoned building. I was hungry. I had a hard time paying attention in class. I was being bullied. I was unable to focus, and I just kept getting hit in every direction, it felt like, because people would think it was a behavioral issue. And it's like, no, I'm actually exhausted and I'm starving and I have a lot going on in my life. And so I can't show up and be a student in the ways that you want when my life is like this. And nobody thought to investigate that aspect. Like, nobody thought about what would tangibly improve my life from, like, a material needs sort of stance. Instead, it was just, like, punitive. Like, now you're in detention. Now you're in suspension. That sort of a thing. And so when they picked up the housing issue, I was just floored. And I knew I had to go up there. And this is a really difficult thing for me in many ways because to a certain extent, I have agoraphobia. I have social anxiety. It's very difficult for me to engage in large crowds when there's a lot of sound and noise all around me. I have a hard time processing everything that's going on. And I can find those spaces very frightening. But that I did not, you know, it was incredible to actually be there, to be marching in the streets. And I kept seeing people that I knew, because it turns out everybody was there. It was a massive march. It was beautiful. I wish that we didn't have the circumstances that required that sort of response, but I am so grateful for all of the people that are willing to pick up the cause for the teachers and the students.
And you're going to, there's an event tonight in Decatur. It's not a, or it's, is it a rally?
It's a dispensary town hall tonight, but there is actually going to be a rally tomorrow in Decatur at 5:30. Because of the behavior of the school board regarding the DFTA strike. They had their health insurance and I believe life insurance pulled. I'm not sure if that's been reinstated at this point, but union busting is disgusting.
Yeah.
And beyond that, the fact that they sequestered disabled kids and kept them out of school while allowing other children to go to school and get an education, that is, it's not just discrimination. I mean, that goes beyond that. That's a denial of their rights. That's horrible. That's the path towards eugenics, right? Like, that's really, really terrible behavior. It proves, there's a federal investigation into that as well, but it proves that the people in power there, not only do they not know how to treat their employees fairly, they cannot be trusted to put the best interest of the students first, right? Like, they are willing to undercut the needs of the most vulnerable students for their own political gain. And that's abhorrent. So I will fully support everyone in Decatur when it comes to pushing for health insurance, for pushing for better contracts, pushing for rights for the students, pushing to get that Board of Education out because they are not competent.
And some other things you're doing, I kind of saw on your Facebook page, and with it being fall, which is essentially almost, I mean, we just had our first snow on Halloween, and they're all, and we here at WEF too will usually have a kind of PSAs about the homelessness or kind of
shelters, warming centers, shelters. Yeah.
And I mean, essentially, I don't know, in terms of benefits, I know that sometimes they'll give you like bus tokens. There's not, I don't know if they have any kind of rooms or beds available for the night. From what I remember here at the here at WEFT or public service, it was like, you know, you can't stay. I don't know if you would be able to stay there for how long, but I saw you were getting like, was it kind of like sleeping bags or?
Yeah. So I don't know of any like hotel voucher programs. I know that sometimes some of the organizations have bus tokens available, but it's really spotty whether or not they'll be available. Me with the sleeping bags, that was literally just me with the sleeping bags. And my campaign manager, Alan, we had kind of a a busy day that was a little bit rough for me. I've definitely had some interviews where people have like asked really personal questions about my history, and so that it gets kind of uneasy for me to process, and I can get a little bit overwhelmed. And so I was feeling really, really upset that day. This was before Halloween, and it was the first day that it was supposed to get down to freezing, and none of the shelters were open. It's not the shelter season until November 1st here, although they did open for Halloween, but they had not opened at that point. And I was really, really upset. And then I remembered that someone had given me two giant sleeping bags that I didn't need. And so I just told Alan, I was like, I have to do something to get out of my head and to do something positive for somebody right now. Like, let's go to the viaduct, to the parks, wherever. Like, let's find somebody. Somebody needs these. So we did. We went to a park, and it only took about, I would say, 3 minutes before I came across a man in jeans and a long sleeve t-shirt. He was bald and had no hat, no gloves, nothing. And he was shaking, and he was just wandering around the park. And he was very frightened at first, because I think that most people would be if, like, somebody is approaching you in a park at night and it's dark and it's cold and you don't really know what's going on because you're probably on the cusp of hypothermia, right? So it's going to feel really dangerous, and you might be feeling kind of powerless. And, you know, so I just, you know, gently introduced myself, and I was like, I have a couple of big sleeping bags in my car. Would you like them? I can bring them to you. So got the sleeping bags and just gave them to him, got him a hat, you know, that sort of stuff. And, you know, I may have saved that man's life. I don't know. I don't know if he's okay now.
Well, you definitely helped his situation. For I mean, that's all you could do is just kind of help him, you know, at that moment.
So. Right, exactly. And I'm poor. Mm-hmm. I'm still poor. I have a bunch of debt. So oftentimes I feel powerless to help because I think I can't donate money, and you know, I do a lot of work, so it's hard for me to even donate time, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if you're the kind of poor that requires you to have multiple part-time jobs so that you can patch together an income. Like, you don't have the time and energy to put into uplifting your community. But I think it's really important to note that there are really small things that everybody is capable of doing. Especially, I worked in the restaurant service industry for a very long time, including in downtown Champaign, and that's where we have a large homeless population. So if people were looking for a way to help out, if you have extra hats and gloves or scarves or anything like that, bring them with you to work. So when you get off of your shift, you can just kind of pass them out if you see somebody in need, right? Like, that's a really small gesture that goes a long way and has a tangible material impact for the person. And no, it's not enough, but it's a start, and it helps build connection. It helps people feel like they matter. I think one of the most disheartening things about homelessness that people don't really think about is that people often walk by homeless people, they divert their gaze. They don't even want to make eye contact because they feel so uncomfortable. And that's really hurtful. It's really harmful to see someone suffering and just walk over their body like they're nothing. People do it because they feel uncomfortable, or they feel bad, or they feel guilty. But think about what the person you're stepping over feels, right? It's going to be 100 times worse than whatever you're feeling. So even if you have nothing that you can give monetarily or physically, you can give kindness to people. You can give people basic decency. You can say, I'm so sorry I can't help you right now, but I care about you. You know, you can acknowledge their existence. You can smile at somebody. It costs $0 to be nice in a real way. So I think cutting through that sort of despair and helplessness is really, really difficult for people, but we need to get there.
Well, I guess with, you know, homelessness, in a way, I guess the old saying is, well, they've been failed by the, I guess you would say, the system, I guess, in certain terms of whether that be education, whether that just be they just can't get work. And then, but of course, you know, a lot of homelessness, you know, they're maybe, you know, have, you know, mental issues or any other kind of, you know, I guess, problems that, that maybe, you know, I mean, I don't want to say drug addiction because, I mean, it can be a number of, and I think it's a sense of, you know, that kind of mentality of, well, it's not my problem, it's not my, you know, it's, you know, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm living my life, my own, you know, my own way. It's just like, it's that sense of, you know, it's not, you know, it's not my problem, because, you know, I got my way of going to life, or, you know, and I don't know. And I think it's, you know, we're all a community here, and I think that's kind of what people meant, or don't see it that way, that, you know, it's that old thing, you know, we're all in this together, you know, and I think that's something as a community we don't, or people don't see it that way, I guess, or...
Yeah, I feel like we've lost compassion to this sort of nihilistic tendency, and that's a really frightening way to live your life, to center yourself and your own needs over the needs of everyone else. It's an attractive idea. I understand wanting to have your needs met, but we do it to the point of gluttony in our society, right? So if you have the means and others do not, I personally believe that it is unethical for you to hoard, right? Yeah. We have shows where we make fun of people for hoarding physical things, right?
That's a show on, I forget which channel, it's called Hoarders or something.
Yeah. Yeah, so we mock people who have this tendency in certain scenarios, and we applaud people who hoard money and resources. You know, corporations buying up energy companies and water companies, that sort of stuff. Like,
or they ship their money, you know, to like the Cayman Islands so they can not have to pay taxes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And, like, that is immoral, unethical behavior that is causing people to suffer and die. People who hoard money at this point, really kind of murderers. Like, it sounds really extreme until you think about how many homes have been lost in California because of the poor behavior of PG&E.
And I know this is just kind of, I don't know if you've heard, and Utah did have a program where they were essentially giving homeless people homes. And it worked well for, I think they would give them kind of like a sense of public funding or, I think eventually, unfortunately, it ended just because it just ran out of money. And I don't know much more. I don't know if this was like a few years ago, I think, but, I don't know if you're, that was just an example that came out, that when I was thinking about, you know, the homeless issue and problem that's all around, I mean, it's all around America. And of course, if you go to any big city, you know, I've been to, you know, past few years, I've been, you know, to Chicago, Denver, and you always, you know, big cities, and of course even here, but especially in big cities, you always see homeless.
Yes. Yeah. People don't realize that homelessness actually looks considerably different when you're talking about smaller cities and rural populations. homelessness in those scenarios is more likely going to be people couch surfing, or we find higher instances of people staying in abusive relationships for housing, for example. So we have people who are housing insecure or homeless, but they're technically staying somewhere, but they're not staying somewhere safe. They're not staying somewhere secure. They're not staying somewhere where they have control over their lives, right? This is a problem that disproportionately affects women and LGBTQ people in many ways, because of things like income inequality, right? That factors into it. Or when people have children in two-parent households, who usually has to give up their career? Who winds up in the economically dependent position?
The wife, because she usually goes from taking a job, then when they have kids, the wife then becomes, well, she's the mother, so she has to be, and there is that society sexist view we have here, definitely here in America, that usually it's the mother that takes care of the kids, the father goes to work, it's that kind of,
right.
I feel like we've had since, what, the 40s?
It's been a while. yeah, exactly, and these issues also disproportionately affect people of color because of the historical process of basically pushing people out of home ownership, you know, lots of predatory lending, again, pay wage gaps. You know, African American women make even less than white women, and that affects people. I also know that because of things like increased criminalization, increased policing in certain communities, particularly communities of people of color, that they also suffer higher rates of civil asset forfeiture, right? Yeah. And because we don't have a right to a civil attorney, getting it back is prohibitively expensive, even though I think it's something like 1 in 6 cases involving civil asset forfeiture result in a conviction. So people get their property stolen.
Yeah, the police, and for people who don't understand, that's when essentially the police, even if a person is their property, whether it's like money or just anything.
Money, cars, homes, boats, it can really be anything. Basically, if somebody gets pulled over and the cop says, I think there could be drugs involved, that's reason enough to seize the car, regardless of if they own the car.
Yeah.
And then the owner is responsible for getting the car back if they even can. They have to go through the courts for that. And I believe it was 2010 to 2017, Illinois took in something like $226 million through civil asset forfeiture. That's an astounding amount of property that belonged to real people with real lives that might not be able to get to work anymore because they don't have a car, or they might have lost their home. It's ridiculous.
Another, some just kind of more of issues that just for people who see your campaign, especially your campaign flyer, there is a red umbrella on it, and that's been kind of like a symbol. Would you say that's been kind of like a symbol of your campaign? And if you want to talk about what it means.
Yeah, so it is not just a symbol of my campaign. That is the symbol of solidarity for sex workers globally. It represents our commitment to ending violence against sex workers. In fact, December 17th is International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers, and frequently there are events for community members and events that are open to the public, that sort of thing, that happen all over the world during that day. It's a very important day to me. But the red umbrella means the world to me. And when I decided to run, I wanted to put it in my campaign logo because it symbolizes to me my commitment to always center the needs of the most vulnerable and to always have a survivor-centered approach when it comes to things like legislation. It's such a part of my value system. That's been an interesting thing because I've definitely seen the red umbrella crop up in somebody else's fundraiser promotional materials desecrated. And I know it's because they don't care. I know it's because they don't even care enough to research what it means, right? A red umbrella is a pretty weird thing to put on a campaign logo, right? So you would think that maybe you would research a little of the symbolism before you put it on your Democratic fundraiser flyer, all trampled and covered in leaves, but they didn't do that. And that, it hurts. It goes back to this issue that I keep coming up against where I have a hard time discerning if people just don't know about these issues or if they just don't care. And unfortunately, I've been in a lot of spaces in politics now, but also in social services, where after they have known, they have proven they still don't care. So that red umbrella is everything to me. And I hope that when other people see it, they know what it means. I hope that they respect it. I hope that people find comfort in knowing that somebody will always champion them, right? Like, regardless of whether it's me doing things with federal policy in the halls of Congress or if I'm just on the streets with sleeping bags, that red umbrella informs who I am.
And another issue that you've been big on has been rent control.
Yes.
Kind of tell me why that's such a... we've been talking about homelessness, but of course...
Yeah.
Connects with
it. Yeah, especially when we talked about rent burden, right? Rent control... There's been a ban on rent control, meaning that the state hasn't been able to set limits on how high rents can rise. They say that the market does it. The market is deadly, apparently. And so perhaps we should step in. So yes, I support lifting the ban on rent control because this is a really, really important tangible way to provide relief for the people that are suffering most with housing costs. And if we reduce their housing costs, they're going to have more money for food. They are going to have more money for their health care. And when they have more money for those things, they're going to have more money, energy, and time to be engaged in our communities in meaningful ways. And so for me, I feel like when we're talking about the hierarchy of needs, you have to have a home before anything else in order to have a life. You have to have a place to live that feels safe, that feels nurturing, that is going to allow you to really take care of yourself, because you can't help others if you can't take care of yourself, right? And I don't mean that in like a bootstrap self-care sort of way. I mean, there should be community care involved in that too. But you have to have a place where you can have peace with yourself, right? And that's what a home is for. So ensuring that people have access to adequate housing is really important. And again, this also impacts things like domestic violence, right? Like if we made it easier for survivors of domestic violence to leave and find a home, we would have less suffering.
And another issue. you also went to the Mother Jones, that there was a Mother Jones event in Springfield. Who was the one at the
Sarah Nelson? Sarah Nelson was the speaker. I was so excited. She is amazing. I recommend everybody go look her up and listen to her speeches. She is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, the AFA. I've been learning so many acronyms lately. Yeah. It's very difficult to keep them all straight. But yes, I did go to that event, and that was the first time I'd actually ever been to a large event like that. And it was just, I got to take my oldest kid with me, and we got to take pictures with a cardboard cutout of Mother Jones with, like, saucy quotes, and I got to meet a lot of people that are just really, really dedicated to building community power and building worker power, and it's so hard for me to really explain, like, how big of a deal this is to me, because I think a lot of people, I say I'm from the working class, but I've only ever really worked service jobs for the most part, or I've done, like, exotic dancing, for example, but I haven't actually worked places where I've even had the opportunity to be in a union. Like, I tried to get people engaged in starting a union back in 2002 when I was a dancer, but people weren't really ready for that yet. And I know that right now people are working really hard to hopefully get a food service union here in town, and I fully support that. But historically, I haven't had access to that sort of collective power. I'm a rung below that. So it was really powerful for me to be allowed to be in that room and see what that looks like, and to see what sort of possibilities exist for people like me. It was incredible.
And another issue, and again, it's kind of pertaining to really, it seems like all these issues are really interconnected, but you're for a single-payer healthcare system, essentially. I guess you would, what's now, you know, with this presidential race going on, Medicare for All, what can you kind of, why do you support a single-payer or Medicare for All, system?
Well, so I can give you one reason that is really relevant to what's happening in the district right now, and that's the DFTA issue, right? Yeah. Does anybody believe that the school board should determine whether these people live or die, given how they behave? I don't believe they should have that power. I don't believe that healthcare should be a bargaining chip that corporations get to use to control their workers. That's horrifying. Part of the reason they're having a rally tomorrow is because somebody couldn't get their chemotherapy treatment because of what the school board did. That's terrifying. That's monstrous. It's immoral, you know. And in a personal way, I have a chronic illness. I actually have a couple of autoimmune disorders. I like to collect. And so for me, things like protections for pre-existing conditions is really important. Most countries don't have pre-existing conditions. They just call it your medical history. Like, they don't use it as a tool to push people out of health care. My mother, she had cancer, and she didn't get to have any sort of preventative care or screening or anything like that. You know, she had a couple of years where she had a lot of headaches. She treated them with aspirin and ibuprofen. And then finally they got so bad, she went to the doctor. She had brain cancer. She was diagnosed on February 14th of 2007. She died April 4th of 2007. This idea that I keep hearing that we don't need purity in healthcare is eugenic. It will lead to the death of predominantly people struggling with disabilities, chronic illness, things like cancer. It's going to I say it's going to, it does disproportionately affect people of color. It disproportionately affects workers. It disproportionately affects so many of us in these jaw-dropping ways. It breaks my heart that, you know, people use GoFundMes to try and pay for medical bills. And the thing is, none of these procedures, prescriptions, doctor visits, they don't cost as much as we're being charged. It's artificially inflated. It's corrupt. You know, it's devastatingly evil.
I know the price of insulin here is much more expensive than it is, say, in Canada. I'm not sure the man who created insulin, but he never wanted it to be as expensive as it is right now in the United States. Yeah.
I mean, my youngest had an egg allergy when they were young. And usually we would have an EpiPen on hand because that's how you...
that's how you're prepared for it.
And the EpiPens, you know, they have an expiration date. I think they only last a year. So even if you don't use one, you still have to buy them. And at one point when my kid was really young, the EpiPen cost $500 out of pocket. The insurance that we had wouldn't even cover it. And, you know, as a parent, what do you do when that happens? Like, well, you buy the EpiPen and you starve. You know, like, you eat nothing but tortillas with cream cheese on them because that's all that's left in the fridge other than the food that you've set aside for your kid. You know, like, that's what you do. I don't want anybody to be in that position. I'm not happy that I was put in that position. You know, I think that I have every right to be flaming mad, right? You know, my kid could have died. And many kids probably have died because they didn't have access to something like an EpiPen.
They're forced to either have to rationalize or, you know, not kind of, I guess, space out their dosage or their times that they take it. And a lot of times you can't do that. You have to...
Right. That's why the insulin is such a big deal, because we're talking about maintaining homeostasis in a body, right? Scientifically, insulin is a necessary requirement. You know, this is not a superfluous medication. And yet we deny it to people. For what reason? The only reason that I can figure out is so terrible people can make more money, or terrible people actually want people like that to die, or both. There's no other good reason. Well, those aren't good reasons. I'm just saying there's no other reason, right? Like, do you want to make money? Do you want people to die? Those are the only reasons to jack up prices.
And I guess, from here on into, because your deadline to be on the ballot is, you have to have a certain number of signatures by December.
It's early in December. The week after Thanksgiving is the week that you can turn in your signatures.
So what would you say, what's the strategy? Just keep, you know, getting your name out there, you're canvassing, you're knocking on doors.
And, you know, I've been going around to organizations and community groups throughout the community. I'm really bad at campaigning and being a politician.
It's your first.
Right.
Give yourself a little break.
Well, I'm terrible at self-promotion, but I don't like the idea of just going to events as like a photo op and, you know, collecting signatures that way, doing fundraisers, that sort of stuff makes me really uncomfortable. I feel like everything that I do needs to be useful and serve a purpose in the community. So for me, my approach has been not to actually create a bunch of events where it's like, come check me out. It's for me to go to the places where people are already active and to say, hey, how can I help you? I'm doing this thing. It's outside of my comfort zone, but I'm going to try it for these reasons. And how can we work together to get what we need in our communities? And so the approach has felt a lot more organic and conversational in that regard. So that's kind of what I've stuck with. I mean, I do knock on doors, and I still have been doing like Lift the Ban canvassing and that sort of stuff. So I am still engaged in some ways that are a little bit more traditional, but it's definitely a different approach, I think, from a lot of other people.
Well, is there anything else you want people to know about your campaign? Any other kind of, we've seemed to have learned quite about where you stand on the issues and how you feel about
them.
How long have you lived here in County or Champaign?
So I have been here since 2009, with the exception of a 1 year break where I tried to live in New York City and found it unbearably expensive. And then I was like, I need to go home where I can actually afford to do the cool things when they happen, as opposed to living in a city where cool things are always happening and I could never afford to go. I didn't really understand the concept of, like, fear of missing out until I was in New York City. And then I was like, oh, now I get why this is a thing. But yeah, so I've lived here for 10 years. I was born and raised in Leroy, Illinois. I lived in Bloomington Normal for a little bit. I lived in Peoria for a while. Basically all along 74. That's Interstate 74. That's my jam. Mm.
Is there, and if people want to find more about you,
yes, Stephanie2020.com, and my name is spelled with an F, so Stephanie with an F, 2020.com, and then, Twitter handle, Steph,
you're new at Twitter, right?
Oh my gosh, I am very new at Twitter. That's a learning curve for me.
So yeah, it definitely has been a lot of things where you have to be something out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Do things that are very new to you.
Right, yeah. I think that people have this misconception because I'm very straightforward in the way that I speak, and I present myself really boldly. If you check out my website, you will see that.
It's a grassroots
campaign. Right. Yeah, I think that people just expect that I am going to be more about, like, self-promotion or social media, like, gaining notoriety and fame. And the truth is, it's actually my life dream to be a recluse. And I just want to actually write and paint and draw. And then when I pass away, you know, somebody will find all of that and maybe make a museum exhibit someday. Right. Like, I just want somebody to come into my home after the cats are done eating me and be like, wow, she wrote 18 novels. We had no idea.
Well, if whether or not you win, maybe that'll be another thing they...
Right. Right, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I feel like I have to fight for the future I want. And so I need to ensure that there is a planet for me to disappear into the forest on. But, yeah, so Twitter, that's been a learning curve. This notion of being a public person is really uncomfortable in general to me.
But it's something that you're... You know, you've kind of, if you're running for office, you have to kind of get in, you know, kind of overcome your, as you said, your public anxiety, your kind of...
I mean, I think the thing that really helps with it is that I don't think I have a better option for making an impact, right? Like, I understand the gravity of the issues that I'm talking about and the ways that they are going to affect people. And when you understand that this really is a life or death moment, when you understand that the children are terrified. They know that the planet is dying, and they want to see adults take strong action. You know, when you have all of that going on, how can you not act, right? It starts to feel really selfish for me to have, like, social anxiety in that regard. You know, it makes me feel like I have a responsibility to take care of my mental health in a way that I don't think that I did before. Whereas before, when I had social anxiety, like, I could put it aside so that I could wait tables for the night, that sort of thing. And I just spend my days off at home in bed. And, like, I did my research, I donated to places. That was kind of my activism. But, you know, that's not going to work for me now. So I have to overcome those issues, because the other issues mean so much more to me.
Okay. Stephanie Frank Smith?
Yeah, Frank is a childhood nickname. Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you so much for doing this interview with me. Good luck with your interview. I know you have a lot to do, and you got an event tonight, so I'll let you get going on that. But thank you so much, and if you ever want to come on again, please feel free, because I know this is going to be it's all the way to, and I'm sure you'll get, from what I understand, you probably have enough signatures to be in the best, but you got a long road to primary day. So, which, it's by true. The way, primary is on March 17th, and you can register. Well, if you
register to vote now, because if you signed my petition and you're not registered to vote, your signature is going to be cast out. So, go register to vote right now, everybody. Do it, just please.
Stephanie, thank you so much, and good luck on that. Campaign trail.
Yeah, thank you.
And again, thank you to Stephanie Frank Smith for coming out and doing that interview with me earlier. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air here on WEFT are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. I just will read one more kind of thing coming on, and I'll have some guests with me here in a little bit get into this. But also there will be an Illinois single payer coalition meeting on November 16th, 2019 starting at 2 p.m. and that's going to be at the Champaign Public Library, Pavilion Room B. And yeah, it's on November 16th, hosted by the ISPC, the Illinois Single Payer Coalition. And I do have a guest with me. If you want to introduce yourself.
Hey, how you doing? Can you see the little bars? Am I too loud? I don't have headphones on.
Sorry.
It's very nice to meet you, Ben.
Yeah. Nice. And it's nice to be back again. My name is Ben, and I've been here at WEFT before, and this is I guess we're calling it where we are at now. It's
Wow, where we're at now. Well, that could cover a broad range of subjects there.
Yeah.
And I understand you take the time to listen to other people and share that.
Yeah. Just try to get as many people's public views on issues, and a variety of now we have this election kind of already starting in. I know for a lot of people that it might be kind of like, what is all right? Didn't we just get done with enough?
Well, you came to the right spot then, because WFT definitely, you are allowing the voice of the people to be heard on the airwaves, and we certainly appreciate that. Very much.
It's an honor. I enjoy just kind of going out covering politics. People in the race.
This is a great time. The views and opinions expressed here on air are those of the speaker and do not represent those of WEFT, Prairie Air Incorporated, other associates, anybody else. It's just you and your opinion, or me and my opinion, when we're on the air. Yeah, and isn't that great to be a part of a station? We can do that.
Now, I know you're here for somebody else's show, Julia.
I am Miss Juliet for radio theater. It's coming up. There's a lot of great, fun, hilarious shows. And if you ever, I don't know how old you are, but there used to be, radio shows were the thing before television.
Mm.
Yeah. So that started first.
Yeah.
So now I'm not sure what episode Miss Juliet has ready for us, but you do have that available. And thank you for tuning in to WEF